morning to everybody. Today we'll be concluding the class on the crowns. We'll start in just about 2 minutes, and we'll recap all the questions and answers, and hopefully come away with a very nice appreciation for the verses and the message. And once the audio stream starts, we just ask you to type in audio okay. That'll confirm for us that you're picking up the audio stream fine. On the Jewish Times, the March 14th issue, we did write up what we have been discussing. So if you'd like to have it in a text format, by all means, see this week's Jewish Times. Answer period at certain intervals throughout the class. So we just ask that you keep the questions to the topic until the end of the class when, if there's time, we can take questions on other issues. Good morning, Doug. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Rabbi.
How are you?
Good. I sure enjoyed reading your article about the crowns and that in your Jewish Times.
Good. Hope you get my message. I'm going to be putting your comments in this week, so I need some time just to go through it. I want to maybe just couch it with reference, because I think it just needs a little backdrop.
Yeah, I kind of felt that was a bit wordy, too. So.
No, not wordy. I just want to see when you were writing it to me. We were discussing it for the past 2 weeks, so we had a body of reference to understand where you were speaking from.
Mm-hmm.
So I just may want to just give a little bit of a preface so people understand, but I think the way you wrote it was perfect.
Mm.
You do any freelance writing, we could hire you. But you know, it's amazing how this one area. Are you telling me when we're waiting for anybody else to join? In the way, a few more minutes?
Unfortunately, I got the message out so late, I'm not sure.
Okay, we could wait, but I mean, after like 10, 11 hours, I think we should start. What do you think?
After 10 or 11 hours?
or
not.
I guess we'll give it another minute, but there's an interesting new insight based on what we're discussing that just really pulls it together. It's amazing, isn't it? I'll recap it a bit, and so we can have a full scope, you know, looking at it from beginning to end, and just see how all the pieces of the puzzle fit in. It was interesting. Yesterday, I just want to welcome Kuzari, who just joined us, a new member. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Kuzari, you're in. I'm not really sure where you're in, but you actually run some sort of a group online that's been getting some negative feedback into the Torah, so hopefully we'll be able to help your group out and give some clarification. So Kuzari, welcome, and Doug and Cal Taylor online. Who else is online this morning?
Nothing yet.
So just you and Doug?
Yeah.
I think it's just us.
Okay. Okay. Okay, Kuzuri. So, I was just going to mention, just, you know, in passing, since we just wait a moment or two for people to log on, yesterday I had stopped by a friend of mine, so he was hosting there in New York a group that Rabbi Alan Wild started called the Manhattan Jewish Experience. And he had, they have what they call a fellowship program for people who are, you know, very dedicated to learning. They're becoming observant from non-observant background, of course. And well, a couple of the sentiments were echoing the same tone about how it was difficult for somebody mid-30s, late 20s, to start making the change because their peer group gives them some flack about their becoming observant. So evidently there's a pull to want to be like others and not to want to, you know, receive disdain or any type of, you know, mockery. So clearly a person who's becoming observant, you know, whether the person is Jewish or not, a person who's trying to live properly, so if they're going to receive the disdain of others, they should realize right away that this is not, you know, somebody who's a real true friend. I mean, that's the first thing. Unfortunately, people have the need for friendship. Hopefully, they'll be able to find even more permanent and valued relationships in the observant circles, you know, whether it's Noahide, whether it's Jewish. But I noticed that sentiment. But the interesting phenomenon, if you think about it, is that if you change to be like your friends, meaning instead of becoming observant or whatever it is, you want to just be like them so they like you, well, what happens when they change later on in life? I mean, you're pleasing a person, you have to realize it's only temporary. So, you know, we brought up that point, how then you're not even living for yourself. So you're saying the other person is more important to live for. There's a number of, you know, salient points that should really ring true, and a person will have to break away from that, you know, the need for the approval of others. And then on the flip side of the coin, some people were talking about how they had brothers and sisters who would taunt them for 8 years after their commitment to become observant. Amazing. These are adults, you know, 40s, 50s, whatever, and they're acting like children for no reason. And ironically, those very people ended up marrying non-Jews, and then when they wanted to have a circumcision on their son, even though the child was not Jewish, they felt so distraught with their anti-Jewish wife, who didn't want to have it and wanted to have the child baptized, and they made the person go just in the opposite extreme and start to appreciate more that he wanted to leave on something. So it was an interesting discussion in terms of, you know, what people go through.
Rabbi, did you all reach the conclusion that people who do taunt the one who becomes observant, what their reasoning is for doing that?
I think clearly the reason is a need to justify their own position. So they have to make a mockery. See, really, if a person is indifferent to what somebody else, let's say I'm not observant, then my brother starts to become observant. So let him do it. What is it? What's the difference to me? But the reason why I must taunt him is because it bothers me. There's some sense of a regret that I have about what I'm living. And the truth is, a person knows if they're not living a life based on anything that's thought out. What's the saying? The life that is, there's a saying, is not worth living. I forget it offhand.
The unexamined life is not worth living?
Right. Who said that? Socrates? Aristotle? Somebody?
I think it's Henry David Thoreau.
Really? Okay. I was close.
I'm not 100% certain, but I think it was Thoreau.
I was close, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the zone.
I couldn't get further afield if I said Mr. Magoo. All right.
Rabbi?
Yes. And by the way, just for the new people that are joining in, let me just give the format, and maybe Kuzuri, you can just give the information to your group that is joining us today. We'll discuss a topic, we'll take questions on the topic, and at the end, we'll take free questions. All right, so the class will go about an hour. All right, Kuzuri, and welcome to Seidler and Madeline. And Cal, go ahead. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
This certainly is a topic that has hit close to home for both Doug and myself. And I've often wondered, looking back at the history of the Jews, they've always been a minority. And it takes a lot of courage to continue to challenge your own thinking and to search for truth no matter what. And I can't help but think that that's by design, because that helps build character.
That they had to go through trials? Well, is that what you're saying? Trials was purposeful?
Well, it just seems like, you know, the Jews have always been a minority.
Right.
And for those people that choose to question their own upbringing, you know, like Doug and I have, and to step away, even though it's not the popular thing to do, it tends to build character, and you continue, it almost encourages you to continue to want to question and to fine-tune your thinking.
Right, but there's also the aspect of justice that God will not afflict. It's actually a verse, we were just reading this past week, from Echa. It says, God does not afflict from his own heart, meaning he does not cause affliction. What he will do is, if a person warrants because of sin, so then he'll bring about a corrective measure, which is what we call a punishment. But if a person did not sin at all, so then there's no punishment, unless what you're saying is it's not a punishment, but God recognizes that there's a certain amount of benefit that the person will need. For example, you know, Abraham didn't sin, yet God told him, leave your land, but that was for his own benefit. So he put him through, you know, leaving, you know, Rashi says it minimizes wealth, a few other things it says when you travel, so travel from land to land, it has a detracting effect on a personality. And it's because you don't have all the comforts of what you're used to, your emotions are now a little bit of an uproar. A person likes, on the other hand, to have, you know, a steady day by day. They know there's no surprises. There's a comfort, but with complacency comes stagnation. So, if you're saying that even though they didn't sin, they were put into situations where they can grow, 100%, I agree with you. That a good example would be in the desert for 40 years. Although they did get that as a punishment, but for the people who did not sin, they still were in the desert, so there was a benefit to them, meaning, you know, Moshe and Joshua and Kalev. So they had to endure the 40 years as well, but there was definitely benefit to that. But even while they were there and getting punished, God did not just punish them, but the punishment was, it was cultivating good ideas. Their reliance on God, because they said, we can't go into the land by the spies. The event of the spies. So they denied God's word that they could go into the land and they would be successful. So God created a situation where they would have to rely on him daily. The mun, you know, the mun of righteousness came down, and it only lasted that day. As soon as the sun came out, it melted it, and there was nothing left. So they had no sense of, you know, their pantry being full. So they knew each day they had to depend on God for their food. So that cultivated a reliance on God, which they did not have yet.
I think that that's a good point, because I found that the rewards that I've got are rewards that I didn't expect to get. And it keeps you wanting to do this, because it's a continual surprise, it seems. Like, you know, when you talked about complacency, it's sort of like you get into a rut there and you kind of know. You know, there's no surprises, and yet when you're constantly involved in learning, you get these infusions of new ideas that continue to stimulate your mind. And that in itself is the reward and the benefit.
Right, and that's something which you can initiate yourself. That's, you don't have to rely on external stimuli. I mean, Abraham brought himself to a level of perfection as far as he could. But I guess he did not have the knowledge that God imparted to him, that leaving where you are right now was necessary for you now to reach another level. And it could also have been to, for the sake of the nation, and so on and so forth. So, but all these stories teach us what they didn't know, but they knew it when God spoke to them. But then God recorded it for the purpose of the future generations benefiting from the very lessons that he imparted to the patriarchs and the matriarchs. Okay, and Kuzari and Seidler and Madeline online, if you have any questions, since You can hear, but you can't speak. He's typing into the bottom of the screen if there's any questions as we go along, all right? So that's a, you can communicate, we'll see it right away when you, if you type into the bottom of the screen and just hit send. Okay. All right, so we were talking over the past 2 weeks regarding the event of when the Jews, and I was talking to Rabbi Pinchas Rosenthal yesterday, he said there's an argument amongst the rabbis as to what exactly did Moses read to the Jews before they got the Ten Commandments. What was it that the Jews responded to and said, we will do and we will listen? There was a famous statement, Naseh v'nishma. We will do and we will listen. Now, whether it was the statutes in the section of the Torah called Mishpatim, or if it was, as Rashi says, from the beginning of Genesis up to that point, the parsha, the section called Jethro, Yisro. So, nonetheless, they didn't accept the Torah until they heard a portion of it, a sampling of it, including the fundamentals. So that's important to know, because Judaism is not based on just, you know, accept the Torah, I'm going to kill you. That's a ridiculous way to live. God gave us intelligence for the prime reason that he wants us to engage intelligence in the most important area of our life, and that is, of course, our religious life, our relationship with God. So therefore, Moses read a section of the Torah which represented the fundamental ideas, and the Jews accepted it. It made sense to their mind. And they said, we will do this. We will accept this system, and we will also listen to what you will tell us in the future and accept that as well. So the two statements. And the questions, of course, which we address, we'll recap, is why they received these crowns at that point. What are these crowns? And why they lost it by the sin of the golden calf. And why the temple was the proper response to that. So it's three things. All right, so just if I forget to answer one of them, please let me know, okay? So again, so what the Jew, when the Jews accepted the Torah, it was not accepted blindly. I mean, there's a medrash, of course, the rabbis say that they wrote, you know, the rabbis wrote metaphor to teach ideas because, number one, as Rabbi Chait explained, the metaphor will keep the idea away from people not ready for it. And number two, it will at least safeguard those ideas because they're transmitted. It's amazing stories people don't forget. God held a mountain over the Jews at Sinai and said, accept the Torah, and if not, I'm going to drop the mountain on you, and this is going to be where you'll be buried. So, of course, that didn't happen, because they said, we will accept it, when Moses read to them a good portion of the Torah. But then we have to decipher what that metaphor is of the rabbis, that God held Sinai over their heads. And it's basically, it's telling you there was coercion. That's what that metaphor is telling you, that what they witnessed at Sinai was different than all the other miracles that they had at this point. Because all the other miracles up to this point could be fit into nature. They were natural phenomena. The timing was an amazing thing, how Egypt was engulfed with frogs and locusts. And these things can happen, most probably not on the scale that they did, but certainly they would not have been predicted to the exact moment like Moses did, and then they would happen. So that is the one element by Egypt that, you know, surely shows that those were miraculous. But there's still left room for a person to, you know, you see that Pharaoh hardened his own heart. For the first five plagues, he was able to just, you know, have his magicians duplicate a few of them. But Sinai was different, because Sinai was an event, a very unique event. And the one unique event about Sinai, and again, if you seek out if you ask really exact questions and you're not satisfied with, you know, just an excuse of an answer, but you look at the words and you ask on every single nuance, you'll find answers. So one of the questions we have to ask by Sinai is, why did God create the miracle that it was a mountain on fire and a voice coming out of the fire? Okay. And the answer is that in order to prove that there is a non-physical existence that is intelligent, what you have to do is you have to disprove the notion that what was talking to them was of the earthly world. So anything on earth, you have life in any element. You have life in water, you have life in the air, you have in the sand, there are animals that have very, very narrow nostrils that can breathe sand, they can breathe air under the sand, and their nostrils filter out the sand and just take in the air. So every single part. In the Antarctic, in the ice, there is life. There are insects. The one thing which does not tolerate life is what?
Fire.
Exactly, fire. So God wanted to create a proof of an intelligence that is not biological, that is not of this world. So when the Jews witnessed that voice, and they heard an intelligent sounding voice from the fire, they knew now that this was a different type of a miracle. Maimonides talks about this as well, but I just want you to see that that is the unique element why that was used at Sinai, okay? So anywhere where there's God is telling us something in the Torah, if we dig for the answer, we'll find a beautiful gem. Okay, so the Jews, before that even happened, you know, Moses read to them the fundamentals of the Torah. They accepted it, and then they also said, we accept whatever you will tell us in the future as well. So the events that transpire are that after Moses went up to the mountain to get the Torah, the Jews miscounted, and he was supposed to come down on the 40th day, but they started counting a day too early. So they thought Moses is now gone, he's dead. And again, it says that the Satan showed him an image of Moses dead. So it doesn't mean that there's this thing called Satan. It means that the person's instincts, the people's instincts, thought it was so real to them, and they're thinking right now that Moses is dead. But it was due to their instincts. That's what it means, Satan, the son. Okay. All right. So what happened was they created the gold calf. Now, why did they do this? Well, again, you look at the verse. The verse says that they went to Aaron and they said, make for us a leader that will go before us, because Moses, the man that took us out of Egypt, we don't know what happened to him. So the extra word in that verse is, of course, the man. Why did they have to say, and Moses, the man who took us out of Egypt? Of course he's a man. But God put that verse in the Torah to teach us what their problem was. They were over-attached to the tangible man of Moses. And once he was gone, they were completely insecure. And you see this very insecurity, this need for something tangible, is the reason why when God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai, he made a command to Moses to rope off the mountain, that the people should not go up to the mountain and try to see something in connection with God, because God is not physical. And if you assume that there's any physicality to God, so that's a grave sin worthy of being killed. And there was a time in history where 57,000 people were killed because when the Philistines returned the ark that they had captured from the Jews, because they were being plagued by the possession of it, so they sent it back, and they realized that the Jewish God is punishing them, so they sent it back. And when the Jews saw it coming on the wagon, pulled by the oxen, they ran to it, they opened up the ark, and God killed 57,000 of them. Okay? So you see that that's a consistent idea. And as well, when Aaron's two sons went into the Holy of Holies without being instructed to do so, they were also killed. So any type of assumption that there's something viewable, there's something physical in connection with God, a person has lost his whole purpose in life. Because anything he's done, all the mitzvahs, all the laws, everything he's done, were all based on a faulty concept of God, a false concept of God. Okay. So, the Talmud says, and actually the verses say that after they sinned with the golden calf, so God told the Jews, actually the Jews, it says, did not put on their adornments. So all of a sudden, the first time in the Torah, we're finding out that the Jews have this thing called adornments. It doesn't say what they are. And there's a big dispute among the rabbis what these adornments are. And this, again, if you want to look in your Chumash, if you have a Chumash with you, take a look, it's Exodus 33 verses 4, 5, and 6. So in verse 4, so the Jews did not put on the adornments. Once they heard that God says to Moses, I'm not going to go up with the people because of the sin of the calf, and if I go up with them for a moment, they will be killed. I can't coexist with them, because if there's a close relationship with them, just like I reward them when they're good, I have to punish them when they're evil. So in order to save them, not kill them, I'm going to create a breach in my relationship that will allow the Jews to live. I won't be so closely connected with them. And then the other nations won't feel that there's a relationship between me and them anymore, and they won't feel that the Jews now have to be punished because their God is not with them anymore. So he's not going to punish them. They're on their own. God eventually listened to Moses, and he reinstated the close relationship. But at this point, the Jews heard that God was not going to go with them, and it says that they did not put on their crowns. Then God tells them, he tells Moses to tell the people, tell them that I will not go up with you. Now he's making an instruction to Moses to communicate this to them as an address. Meaning it's not sufficient that you just do not put on your crowns right now, whatever these things are. But additionally, God says you must not put them on. And that was a rule. This is a one-time thing. The Jews just didn't put it on in response to what they heard. They were mourning. But that is something which passes. And they may have put these adornments on, whatever they are. But God says, no, you cannot put them on anymore. So then the last verse, 6:33:6, Exodus. So then it says that the Jews stripped themselves of the crowns that they got at Sinai. Okay. So that adds on something. Now it says they stripped themselves of the crowns that they received at Sinai. Okay. Let me just pause here, see if there's any questions or comments, because we bit off a little bit here. Let me make sure that everybody is clear in what we're discussing.
We're good here.
Okay. Okay, so one person has a problem with audio on screen. So I just want to post something for him. All right. Okay. So, again, just to reiterate, there is a divergence in terms of the opinions as to what these adornments are. And also, why does God use an ambiguous term? Why doesn't God just say in the Torah that they didn't put their crowns on? And why did they get these crowns? Because they said, we will do and we will listen. Why is this the one unique, the singular event in which the Jews now deserve crowns? So just to recap, because we said a lot of this last week, we said as follows. And that is a very, very interesting idea. Because this was the only time where the Jews actually expressed the perfected state of man. And that is where it's not enough just to use intelligence, because that was the first part. They listened to the Torah that Moses read to them, that portion, and they were convinced of the ideas being true and valuable. And they said, we will accept this Torah. So that is one source, or one reason why they received a crown. Again, they received two crowns because they said two things. So that's the first thing. They demonstrated a life where they followed reason. But it's not sufficient if a person just follows reason, because a person can say, all right, I heard everything so far, the Torah sounds good, but I'm not going to follow anything else until I hear it. So that would be a problem. Because they're now saying that an idea has to pass the litmus test of their own reasoning in order to accept it. And when they say that, they're basically saying that they're expressing a faulty idea of God. Because if a person has the correct idea of God as being the creator, and the creator is the one that created this system of the heavens, the earth, the universe, that worked by precise laws, and he formulated the system of reason that humans perceive, so he is the authority in terms of what is rational and reasonable. So for a person to say that I'll follow what I've heard so far, but nothing more, he is now suggesting that maybe something is not going to pass the test of reason. You understand? That would now be saying there's a possibility that God is not correct on a certain point. Did everybody see that point? That's a very important distinction. I'll repeat it. if a person would just say, I'm going to follow what I learned in the Torah, but they don't say, I will accept everything else, even though I didn't hear it yet. So a person who does that says, listen, I have to hear it first. So they're suggesting that maybe something is not going to pass by their sense of reasoning. So they're putting their reasoning over God's reasoning. You see the problem with that?
Yes. Thank you.
All right, Judith, Seidler, Kathy, Kuzari, everybody see the idea? So that's why they deserve the second crown, because they said not only will we accept what we heard, but they also deferred to God and said whatever he will tell us in the future as well. So that means that they accepted a life of rationality, of reason, of intelligence. Okay, Madeline, thank you. Kuzari, thank you. And not only did they accept a life of intelligence, but they also accepted human limitation. That's equally important, because if a person doesn't accept human limitation, so that means that they'll kill themselves. A very simple scenario will prove this. Person disagrees with his doctor, says, I don't agree with the medication he wants to inject. I'll inject something else in my body. Well, if he injects the wrong thing, he's going to kill himself. All because of his arrogance, and he could not defer to the doctor. So certainly, if you're going to be that careful with your physical life, certainly a person should be careful with their metaphysical life, their soul. Yes, Judith, they were told that my Torah would not be changed forever. Agreed, but they didn't hear the entire Torah when they accepted it. They only heard a portion of it. But nonetheless, they said, based on what we've seen so far, we are convinced that this Torah is now coming from God, and the ideas are sensible, and they appeal to our mind, and they now admitted to accepting that which they didn't hear yet. So I hope that answers your question, Judith. All right. But now what happened with the gold calf? Why did that? And again, we'll still have to get back to the question, what are the crowns? What does it mean that they received two crowns? So again, we at least understand what the unique nature was of the Jews at this point. They had demonstrated the highest level of human functioning. Okay, Judith, good. And Seidler, you're asking, they heard the first two mitzvos, the first two divros. Well, this was not even at the point where they got the Ten Commandments yet. And according to Maimonides, they didn't even hear the words. If you take a look at Maimonides in the Guide for the Perplexed, he means to say that, what does it mean that the Jews heard the first two commands? So he said that Moses was the only one that really heard the distinct words. So what did the Jews hear? The Jews heard some voice that they knew was intelligent and sound, and it could have been like a certain pattern to the voice. For example, if you hear a wind has no rhyme or reason to the pattern. It whooshes, and the sequence is not based on anything mathematical. But if you would hear a wind blow precisely every 5 seconds, you would know for sure that that is now being caused by some intelligence. Right? A wind is impossible that it would blow every 5 seconds. I just continue with that pattern. Pattern means there's a design to the pattern. There's something sustaining a pattern. So this is also what Maimonides says. They heard some unique voice coming from the fire, in the combination with the source of it coming from the fire and it having a certain sound of being intelligent. So they knew it was coming from God. But what does it mean that they heard the first two commands? Maimonides means to say that they had the knowledge of the first two commands on no less of a plane than the prophet Moses. He says that the knowledge that God exists and that all idolatry is false, which are the first two of the Ten Commandments, that is something which a regular person can arrive at perfectly, just like the prophet. The prophet has no advantage over another person in this matter, in these two areas. That's what Maimonides indicates by saying that the rabbinical statement that the Jews heard the first two. It doesn't mean they heard the first two in words. It means that they perceive the truth of those two concepts just like Moses. Okay? All right. So now let's get back to the point. And the point is that they got these crowns because they expressed perfection. Two areas. They admitted to a life of rationality, and they admitted to human limitation. And we'll get to what the crowns were in a second. But why did they lose the crowns with the golden calf? See, the golden calf was an expression of their intolerability to have this metaphysical relationship with God. They needed the physical man, Moses. Now Moses, the man, was God. They couldn't tolerate the fact that they had no medium anymore. So they created something physical to satisfy their sense. And this is where they took a step backwards. Because they originally said, we will do and we will listen, meaning they accepted human limitation. But now, as soon as Moses was gone, that evoked a certain emotional response. And they felt a void, and they could not reach that next level where they can have a relationship with an unknown God. They needed to have something in their framework. So they went back. Now they no longer upheld the statement that we have that there's human limitation. They said, no, we need to have something that is within our sensual realm, something we can see and touch and feel. We can't. They backed up. So because they backed up, because they no longer sustained that commitment to human limitation, and they demanded that something be within their grasp to accept it. So now they lost their crowns. I mean, the very thing which they merited earlier, they now lost. And what was God's response? Since they had a need to have some sort of approach physically to God, so that's why God created the tabernacle as a response to the sin of the golden calf. Because the main focus of the tabernacle, and this is new, Doug and Carol, the main focus of the temple is the Holy of Holies, that we know. But the rule is that you're not allowed into that room. So God creates this temple that the focus where the voice emanated from between the two cherubs and where the tablets and the Torah are located, that one room that's curtained off, you are not allowed to walk into. So why is that the right response? So it makes perfect sense. Because since the sin of the Jews was their inability to relate to God metaphysically, to admit complete ignorance in terms of how, you know, what God is, they demanded, no, we need something physical to relate to God. They didn't say that the gold calf was God. Ramban, Nachmanides, says this. He says, no fool would say that the gold that they took out of their ears and they melted and molded into an animal, this gold that they took out of the ears, is their God? No fool would say that. But they said there's some way this thing has certain forces and that will relate to God that way. So, but they needed something tangible. But that was there was a step backwards. So in order to correct that, God now instructs them with this very idea in a permanent structure of the temple, that I am not approachable. You came up with your own ideas. You created this calf. No, you have to admit complete ignorance. You cannot know me. Moses wanted to know what God is, and God says to Moses, man can't know me while he's alive. It's an impossibility, because man's knowledge is all based on one of the five senses. You read something with your eyes. You hear something with your ears. You touch something. Any one of the five senses are the only vehicles by which man can grasp and obtain new knowledge. But if nothing is in the realm of the physical, a person can't perceive it. A proof would be that a person goes into a dark room, and there's a number of objects in there. There's no way he could know what the objects are because his sense of sight is crippled in that state, so there's no way to perceive it. So God says as well, in terms of my nature, I am not physical, so there's no way to perceive me. You can learn things about me. I've instructed you in the Torah what truth is, how I work in terms of justice, but what my essence is, what my nature is, that you can't know. And that's what the Jews attempted to try to do. They tried to force their relationship to God in some physical way, like creating the calf. So God's response is a reminder, a daily reminder. Look at that temple. You cannot go into that room called the Holy of Holies. And that will remind you that I'm unapproachable. It'll remind you daily that you cannot know me. Okay, so that's what was new from last week.
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
It seems to me, though, that if somebody really wanted to attach God to a physical thing, that they could then say that God exists in that room.
One more time?
Somebody with an incorrect idea of God that wants to continue to attach God to the physical would associate that Holy of Holies area that man cannot go into as God existing in that room. or that area.
Uh-huh. I mean, they would think that he is occupying space.
Right, and that's why they can't go in there, because that's where he exists, and that's, you know, he doesn't want anybody to see him. Kind of like, it reminds me of the Wizard of Oz thing.
Right. What you're saying, makes me recall when King Solomon built the first temple. See, he gave a prayer in front of all the people, and he kept on saying, "And God, you should listen from heaven." He was trying to direct the people that God is not in the house. Maybe precisely for that reason that people might think this. So he keeps on saying, "God, listen from heaven." So to tell the people, in other words, God is not here in this house. This is merely a demonstration. When you see the cloud descend and Moses goes in and God talks to him, so God is not the cloud. I mean, there was no cloud in Egypt, yet you saw all the miracles. So God was always involved in their lives, even without the temple. So what you're saying, I could see that a person might have that problem. And even to bring your point more acute, I think my mind is the one that says that in the Guy After Perplexed, that the reason why you have two golden cherubs on the ark and they're identical is to reject the idea that either one of those is God, because a God has to be unique. In terms of how people have a concept of God, God is unique and nothing else is like him. But if you have two identical cherubs, you can't say either one is God, because you can't say there's two identical gods. That's not something the mind tolerates. So people will reject that the cherubs are there. The cherubs are really to teach, as Rabbi Chen explained, that since the cherubs are on top of the ark, which contains the law, it's to tell you that there's a certain system of how knowledge reaches man, and it's through a system of angels. And more than that, I don't really have. But knowledge is not something, I mean, a person has a question, he doesn't have an answer, so how one second he's ignorant of the answer, and another second he has the answer. So there's a certain way that God imparts knowledge to man. So the angels represent that there is that system. But they are not representing God, of course. Okay. To assume that God is in the temple, they actually had dissembled it and traveled by day with the cloud and by a pillar of fire by night. So again, it was divorced from that room. The room was disassembled, and also the items of the temple were covered in linen and in animal skins. I'm not sure, linen or maybe wool and animal skins. But yet they now saw, even when the temple was disassembled, that the cloud was now leading them by day and then a pillar of fire by night. So perhaps this dual approach was to never let them enough time to attach to either one or the other. So they couldn't say God was a cloud, because then they removed. At night there came a pillar of fire. They couldn't say the pillar of fire was God, because that removed and there was a pillar of cloud. And they couldn't say the temple or the room was God, because it wasn't always structured in a room form. So perhaps this type of shifting helps to remove that very point that you brought up, Cal. Okay, now let me just take a couple of points on screen. Okay, Seidler is writing, and if I miss anybody's question, just type it again. Seidler is writing, I thought it was Rashi who said that it was the mixed multitude of sorcerers who wanted the physical form of God. Right, but if the Jews went along with it, so they also sinned. There was actually the 3,000, I think, of those mixed multitude were killed immediately by the Levites, by the sword. Then God plagued other Jews, okay? And Shoshik, the screen goes up in order to keep the most current entry on screen in front of me, so this way I can see it. All right? Judith, you're writing that. I heard they didn't see the calf, but a symbol. But still, no, they did. They created a calf, all right? And also, just in case the screen sometimes is a runtime error that your screen goes blank, just hit your Enter key. That'll bring you back to the chat so you can see what's being written. No, but they did. They created the calf. It wasn't just a symbol. Okay. And Judith, you write again, they really saw the calf in a physical form of God? No, of course it wasn't God. It was a man-made object. That's why Moses came down from the mountain. He took the calf and he grinded it down. He actually put it in water and gave it to them to drink. A separate reason why he did that. Okay. All right. Doug, Cal, any questions, comments from your end?
We're good.
Okay, so just so we have it clear, they had taken a step backwards from their original perfected statement of that human intelligence is limited. And they took that step back when they said, no, it's got to be within our realm. And they can no longer say that human intelligence is limited. We need to have things in our own sensual realm. So they made the calf. So God's response to help them is now to remind them that you cannot approach me. And this was a mistake. It was a big mistake, a very grave error. And he builds the temple in order to correct that notion. The main concept in a temple is that there's a room that's off limits, that this will now remind them that they cannot come up with their own notions of how to approach God. Only what God says they can do. All right. Now, what is this thing about the crowns? Why is the Torah so ambiguous and it says adornments? And God tells them to take off these adornments. Some rabbis say that the crowns really were crowns. Some say that they were swords. Some say they were clothing. Some say that they were garments. But I think the answer of Ramban and Sforno and Yonos ben Aziel is the correct notion, and that is that there was no real physical crown that they received. When they said, we will do everything God says and we will listen, no. A crown means to say that they had an elevated status of perfection. That's what the crown means. Right, Judas, some said the jewelry also. But all this is really to tell you that there was something of value that they had at that moment, and it wasn't physical. That's why God does not say in the verse what the thing was. He just says there was something that they had which adorned them. What is that? It's a way of... See, why did God even talk about it that way? And he wanted to show you how real perfection is. That is the most valued thing before God, is the human perfection. That's the whole reason he created man, is that man reaches perfection. That he recognizes wisdom. That's why he gave us alone intelligence, and no other creature has intelligence. And when we also admitted a limitation to our intelligence, that was deserving of another adornment. But there was no real physical adornment. The adornment simply means that there was a perfection in the person. But in order for God to communicate to us that that perfection is of such is the most real thing before him, he talks about it as if it's a physical thing, like it's a crown. He doesn't come out and say it's a crown, because it wasn't. That would be a lie. There wasn't a physical crown. But what God wants to do is to show man how there is nothing which surpasses human perfection. And since a human being views, what is the most real thing to a human being? Something physical. So there's a statement, Dibra Torah Kolashim Bnei Adam, that the Torah speaks in the language of man. That means it uses the terminology of man in order to convey ideas. So God did that. God spoke about human perfection as if it was a crown. And he says to them, take off the crown, meaning you can no longer partake of this perfection because of the sin of the calf. There was a severe blow that you just waged against yourself by going back into an idolatrous type of a mode of thinking. So that's why God speaks about it as if it's something real, because it is the most real thing before God. All right, the soul is the most real thing about man, yet it's not physical. So that's what I believe, the reasoning why God spoke about it in this manner, as if it was a physical thing, to convey that this is the most real and valuable thing before him, is when human beings are perfected. But he doesn't use the term keser, which in Hebrew would mean crown, because that would be a lie. They didn't receive any physical crowns that just magically appeared. That didn't happen. They just raised themselves to a high level, which was a crowning moment, that you can say. All right, so now we see why it was spoken about as being like a, as if it was a real physical thing. Okay, makes sense? Anybody have questions, comments?
So he's trying to put it in the language of man, the idea of human perfection. But it's not really a physical thing, but he's talking about it that way so people will grasp the idea.
Yes, that they should understand that this is the most prized thing before God. He talks about human perfection as if it's a physical crown. And the truth is that King Solomon says this. We said this last week. That King Solomon says in the beginning of his book, Proverbs, I think it's 1:6, if I'm not mistaken. It's right around there. Chapter 1, I think verse 6, where he says that living the life of following the commands of the Torah and the philosophy of the Torah, so they will be as an adornment to your head and as necklaces for your neck. He does it as well. He follows God's lead, and he does the exact same thing God does, and he refers to the perfections of the Torah life as if it's a crown, as if it's necklaces, because a crown is something which goes on your head. That's thought. A necklace goes around your throat, your neck. That's speech. So in the areas where a person is engaged in wisdom, which is thought and speech, this is where a person is crowned, as if he's wearing these things, because this is now like a diadem to the person. It's something which is which indicates, like a king. The king in a country, he is the one that wears the crown, to indicate that he is the most elevated of all the members of that society. So when a person is using his intelligence and he's speaking Torah, it's as if he's wearing a crown on his head. It's as if he's wearing necklaces of gold around his neck. So you see that it's used again, the very same purpose. But of course, King Solomon is not saying that, you know, magical crowns are going to appear on your head and necklaces on your neck when you're engaged in Torah study. That's foolish. But the idea is understood. And now we see that God is the one who really originated the concept of referring to perfection as a crown. So when you have corroboration, it just makes the idea, it removes doubt from what the real intent was when God said this way. As you see how the whole sequence was. They reached that level of perfection because they accepted intelligence, number one. That was the first crown that they earned. And number two, they accepted human limitation. So that's the second crown. Meaning it's dangerous if a person feels that he has knowledge in all areas. Then he is certainly foolish. And he deserves no crown. But when a person tries to force everything within his realm, and he says, no, even God, even my relationship with God, there has to be something physical. I'm going to make a golden calf. So now the person stepped back. He's no longer admitting of human intelligence. He's now saying, no, I must have some, it must work within my scope of apprehension. If it's not, I can't accept it. That was a mistake. Because God said to the highest man, man can't know when he's alive. So nobody else can. And then the response to help the people back on the right track is to give them a daily reminder that you cannot approach me. You cannot know what I am. And that's expressed by having a location that is off limits. Not to say that God is in the room, but that there is a limit to your approach to God in this life. You could go so far and that's it. Okay, any questions or comments? And if there's none on this, we could take a few questions on other topics also. We still have like 10 minutes, I think. And Judith...
Good here, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, Judith, that's correct. You're right. The awareness of Hashem's commands, whatever they will be, more or less understood, whether we understand them or not, they come from the Creator. Right, and He's the Creator of intelligence, of wisdom. So that wisdom which which we perceive, He's the one that's really the authority in what makes sense. So how could man be so foolish and argue with God? Okay. Okay. Okay, any questions or comments? It could be on other topics, too. We'll take a few more minutes. Cal, everything's clear?
Yeah.
All right, you see the new step we took today in terms of how the gold calf was a step backwards and how the temple is now a response. We didn't say that last week.
Right.
So, Rabbi, in the Holy of Holies, there is a voice that speaks between the cherubim.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. But Rashi explains that Moses is the only one who hears it.
Not the high priest from generation to generation.
No, the high priest did not have communication. Only Moses went in and he heard the voice. When the high priest went in twice a year, and that was on Yom Kippur, it was to bring in the incense offering. And even when he went into that room, he had to smoke it up in order to even teach him. Even when you're in that room, there has to be a veil between you and God. That was the whole concept of the smoking up of that room. And then he went in later on to take out the burnt ashes.
So the voice heard between the cherubims was only for Moses at the time of Moses?
Yes.
Okay.
Because God, the reasoning is because Moses is the only human being ever that engaged in prophecy while he was awake. So he would perceive a voice. But anybody else who had prophecy was not awake. So they could not share in Moses' prophecy. They would be unconscious. And again, Moses is the only one who had that level of prophecy. But all other prophets were unconscious when they had their prophecy.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Let's see. Judah is asking, the calf shape is not without meaning, right? Right. They probably borrowed the calf from the Egyptian culture that they were in for over 200 years. And you're also asking, someone asked me if there's a link between the ego and Agil and Nezim Zahav. I don't know. I mean, they gave the gold rings, the earrings and those rings, they gave it to make the gold calf. That's how they created it. You know, when you have thousands or tens of thousands of contributors of gold, you can create a gold statue. Okay, Judith? Now, Kuzari, you had mentioned that there were some erroneous notions or ideas that you or some members of your group were getting from some other rooms or groups. You want to communicate what that is now? I think that was your initial email to me last week. A week and a half ago? Okay, you want to tell me what the question was, Kuzari? I'll repeat it out loud so this way Doug and Cal can hear it. I'll just read it from what you're writing on the screen. And again, if anybody missed any part of the class today, we record this and we put it on the audio link. It's about 8 links down on the website on the left-hand side. So you'll be able to listen to it. Usually we post it about a half an hour after the class is over, so you could hear the whole class if you missed any part. So Kuzari, go ahead. What was the questions that you had? I see. So you're just saying that there was some on your Pal Talk chat rooms, you had some Christian messianics that were taking over. All right, well, I guess if you don't have to give them the microphone. That's one of the benefits of the way we have the room set up that we do it here, is that it's only audible from here. And if anybody wants to speak, they can't. They have to type something on screen. So this way, whoever's listening will just hear something which is undisturbed. So maybe you should... You should do that. I don't think a person could force them to take a mic in the Pound Talk room, right? I don't think it's worthwhile to initial Ambrosine, I'm addressing this to you. I don't think it's you're writing that you want to debate with them. Well, I don't think it's a worthwhile endeavor. I think what it's important is that a person should be studying the Torah and spending time debating with other people. Is if you meet somebody on the street, you know, fine. They have a question, you can respond, you don't ignore a person. But you understand that they have a motive. So let them do their own rooms. Your goal should be to try to put as much time into Torah study as possible, not to prove to other people what we already know is wrong. It's just repetition. If a person's honestly looking for truth, then you spend time with them. But somebody who's just trying to grow the number of their followers without even knowing whether their principles are true, it's foolish to waste time with them.
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal.
One of the helpful things that Doug and I learned early on was that if you can't start from a common premise, then there's no point in engaging in a discussion with somebody, because it just turns into a mud-throwing contest.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, there has to be agreed, you're right, 100%. It has to be starting from a common point, and you take it from there. And now it's an investigation in terms of what did God teach over here, what did God teach over there. Right. And Kuzaria, you're just writing that. That's why you contacted us, so you can hear the teaching from Powell. Okay, good. So I'm glad that we can now you'll join us every Sunday. All right, and Cal Seidler is agreeing with your premise that it's a good point. You need to have a common premise. Okay, and all right, any other questions or comments? So a few more moments. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
With regard to getting into arguments with people?
Yes.
A doctor years ago told me never get into a mud fight with a pig because you both get muddy and the pig likes it.
Uh-huh. that's good. Yeah, they usually like to rile you up, you know?
I once engaged in what and I'm not relating this person to a pig, but a person with very strong religious convictions. For days, we wrote detailed letters back and forth, and the person was in an impossible contradiction in their ideas, but they were not willing to look at that. And it became a very futile exercise, and I realized later I had wasted an enormous amount of time trying to move someone who was not moved by logic or rational thinking.
Rabbi Chait was once approached by somebody who says, prove to me that God exists. So he said, well, if I prove to you, will you follow the Torah? And he said, no. So that was the end of the conversation. Rabbi Chait didn't take it any further.
Yeah. Very good point.
Yeah, I mean, I was discussing with them yesterday again. They had this group from a friend's house over Shabbos. So this one person was saying how their friends were taunting them about their becoming observant. So I told them a good response would be, again, if you, like we talked earlier, if this very person would agree that they would go to a doctor and not administer any medication or surgery on their own because they realize that the body is very intricate, so they want to preserve the body, so why do they say that God knows any less than the doctor? I mean, they should admit that God knows even more than the doctor, and they should be investigating with all the spare moments the Torah. And let me see, Seidler, you're writing, the most common premise is that Hashem is one God, not a flesh or anything physical. Exactly. Next week's shiur, we'll post on the website somewhere, Kuzari. So just, you come back to the main page of Masorah, and we have a banner on the right-hand side that says Talk Live, and we'll post there what the topic is. If you want to get the email, just send, you can be notified during the week. So you send an email to subscribe@masorah.org. And you'll be on the list, and you'll be notified. And Judith, you're writing why the Jews engaged in the orgy. You're right, there was an orgy that they had at the time of the eagle. The high awareness of God's almightiness level that they reached was not strong enough for the test. Well, they didn't reach that level, evidently, because they did not receive the Torah. They involved in the orgy before they received the Torah. So, but the reason I believe, I think Rabbi Chait expressed that, is that once the emotions, well, actually, I don't want to quote him, I'm not sure if that's exactly what he said, but I would suggest that once the emotions are let loose, so they spill over into other areas, and of course, sexual is one of the main areas of the instincts, so once they were attached to this gold god, and their religious emotions got excited, so they also get sexually excited. Okay. All right, any other questions? If not, what we'll do is we'll wrap it up, and we'll pick up next week. Same time, 11:15 New York time. All right?
Thank you, Rabbi. This is very, very enlightening.
Okay, if you have any topics, you know, during the week, please let me know. Otherwise, you know, I'll look around. But if you have questions, and again, Kuzari, this applies to you, Judith, Madeline, your group. If you have some topic, if it's on the Parsha, if it's on Purim, since Purim is coming up this Friday, so feel free, you can send the email in and try to approach your questions too. All right, so until next week, everybody, have a good one. And for those of you celebrating Purim, have a good Purim. And we'll pick up next week at the same time. All right, and again, we'll put the class online, so if anybody missed any part of the class, I'd say in about 15 minutes, the class should be online under the audio link on the left-hand side. You'll see the whole bunch of links, and you'll be able to access the class from there. Okay, good week to everybody. Take care.
Thank you, too, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You will.
Bye.